Agung, 是汤姆。
Singaporean filmmaker Royston Tan's gritty, socially conscious movies have won more than 40 international and local awards. They've also earned him a reputation for pushing boundaries, with a film on the life of a group of teenage gangsters that he made in 2003, heavily censored by the Singapore Censorship Board. But his more recent movies have taken a nostalgic turn, which some critics say has taken the edge off his work. Royston Tan was executive producer for an anthology of seven short films, Seven Letters, created by a group of Singaporean filmmakers to commemorate Singapore's 50th anniversary. The film is also Singapore's entry to the Academy Awards this year for Best Foreign Language Film.
Royston Tan, welcome to Conversation With.
Hello.
What about people who say that the anthology was lovely, but sentimental? Are you becoming too mainstream, Royston Tan?
Maybe I'll explain to you a little bit more about seven letters. Because I think the main objective was really to get seven directors to write very personal stories, that seven letters, that they can relate to based on the era that they were born. So all the seven of them actually wrote very personal stories. And I guess inside there, there also has been a lot of issues being raised. So rather than me being mainstream, I also asked that question, is it also because the environment has also opened up? Because if we were to do certain issues, certain campaigns that I've been doing now, right? I think 20, 30 years ago, this wouldn't be possible. But right now, I feel that the authority has allowed us to have a dialogue session with them. We explained to them. In fact, Seven Letters was the one and only project without any interference from the authority.
So none whatsoever. Nobody who gave you funding came along and said, you know, it would be nice if you mentioned some of these things.
No, nothing.
None whatsoever.
Yeah, it was the
there was no tacit pressure in any way.
Nothing. That was the most amazing thing. It was based on a single word, trust. I told them seven directors will be coming in to create this project and they will give you a two-page treatment. And they have not actually seen the script, only a two-page treatment. And after that, 1 year later, the film came out. And this was how it came about.
So you think that censorship has changed now in Singapore from the time when you first made 2003? You did 15. Singapore Censorship Board cut your film 27 times. They made 27 cuts on your film.
That's very painful.
You then went on, in fact, to do a little
personal tribute.
Do you think that would happen again now? In other words, if you did a remake of 15, which basically focuses on young gangsters, young gang members in suburban Singapore, if you made it now, do you think you would get 27 cuts from the censorship board? Or you're saying that no, now it would be different?
I think now it would be different. Firstly, because of the subject, also because the gangster boys have all also evolved. And now with the opening of dialect, it has gotten a lot easier. As you can see, even on television, dialects are actually coming in already. So I would like to think that it has gotten better and it has opened up. But for some strange reason, we have really irritating people that like to complain about many, many things, like a pop singer, like even the bus number 666. I don't know why, but in the past there wasn't all these voices. But right now there's all these very strange voices that just appear out of no reason. Maybe they have nothing to do, or maybe they just need to do something to make some noise to prove that they still exist in this world, kind of thing. So yeah, in fact, I think now our biggest so-called obstacles are not censorship. It's all these ridiculous people who try to, I don't know, save Singapore, and I don't know what they're trying to do. Yeah.
Well, what about if I were to play the devil's advocate, that these ridiculous people, they are part of what Singapore is about as well. In other words, the voices that aren't interested in arts, the voices that think that what you do is unimportant.
Not just unimportant. Sometimes they think of the arts community as demonic. We are the work of the devil and things like that. Then I was just wondering, but if there's really a devil, he must be really busy, you know? There's so many other things to do. Those artists are very, very busy and very poor people with no time to create a piece of work to self-destruct Singapore. That's what I feel. But again, I'm really thankful for all these people because with them in, it allows me to, again, embrace diversity. And when we have oppression, right, it allows to create and stimulate our mind to create even more exciting stuff. So I think for filmmakers, for artists, it's very important for us to have all these little obstacles along the way.
Royston, why this fascination with HDB?
Life in public housing in Singapore, in Housing Development Board or HDB flats, has been a central motif of Royston Tan's films. Acting as a backdrop for the trials and tribulations of his characters and drawing from his own colourful childhood.
Royston, why this fascination with HDB?
Well, when I first saw Eric Khoo's film 12 Stories, I was very, very fascinated because, you know, I stay in HDB, but I don't really see the beauty of it until when I saw how he captured all these little stories of ordinary Singaporeans in all these small little pockets. And that made me very, very curious and very inspired to look out for stories inside. And then if you were to pass by, like during dinner time, walk past the corridor, you really would smell different kinds of food coming up from it. And that's so fascinating for me. And as a result of that, I've always been very fascinated by HDB and the people. Yeah.
Do you think it's really part of the Singapore identity then? HDB, without HDB, we wouldn't be Singaporeans.
To be very honest, I think Singapore identity is always the most ordinary, simple thing that hasn't been engineered. That to me is, which is the most organic stuff. For example, like the culture within the HDB, which is something I find that is still very, very interesting. Neighbours are still helping each other, and then when it's raining, you know, uniquely in Singapore, we had the bamboo thing, hanging
without clothing.
And when it's raining, everybody will be going out of the window and say, "Hey, lo ho liao," you know, that kind of thing. You know, this is something I find that it's quite uniquely Singapore, and maybe the Singapore Tourism Board should actually feature all this rather than all the very, you know, MBS, Malayan and all these things.
You know, or everybody drying their clothes, that's what really makes
it. Yes,
makes
and Singapore. It's very exciting. I really enjoy seeing people drying their clothes. Like, you know, you go to different households and you see like different kinds of clothes, and then you, like maybe, you can even guess, because I like to imagine, right? So I would say, oh, this family, why they wear certain color scheme, and the particular house, why this house have like 8 bras hanging at the same time? Is it because there are so many girls staying in one particular unit and things like that? For someone like me, I find that all these little things are very fascinating.
But it wasn't so straightforward for you, was it? Transitioning from a kampung life to living in HDB.
Yeah, it was a very traumatizing experience for me. I was 7 years old. So I stayed, when I was in the kampung, you know, everybody had their door open and, you know, we can collect rainwater and boil and drink. But when I stayed in the HDB, it was really traumatizing because I was very scared of using the lift. Yes. Yeah.
Why scared of using the lift?
Because for somebody who stays in a kampung for so many years, this concept of lift doesn't exist at all. And everybody being packed in different small little compartments is different. So that became a very difficult transitional period for me, which made me so obsessed with HDB.
Royston Tan's close relationship with his family have also had a significant impact on his filmmaking. With working class households and their daily habits scrutinised with a melancholy tenderness.
So Royston, is it your parents' fault that you're a filmmaker? Is it all their fault that you are the way you are?
I would think so, because they didn't give me the proper kind of, you know, like, for all Singaporean kids, You know, many parents will force them to go for different kinds of courses when they were young. But personally for me, my childhood was very different. I was allowed to just run around in the kampong environment. There was no additional tuition classes. My exposure was, you know, going to the temple to watch Chinese opera. So, you know, this kind of visual stimulation is different from other Singaporeans' kids.
And perhaps you could say, though, maybe yours was the better one in the end because it's made you an award-winning filmmaker. And it's maybe given you that creative edge, which having lots of tuition classes wouldn't have done.
Yes, I was really very thankful to my parents because I told them I don't like to study. And they didn't force me to be who I wasn't supposed to be. And they just asked me, what do I want to do? I said, I like to paint, I like to see colors, and I like to run around in nature, catching fishes in the drain and all this. And they just allowed me to just do. And my parents just told me something like, all we want is you just try your very best. We know that you're not very good in your studies, it's okay. But as long as you tell me you've tried your very best in your studies, then it's okay. But the most important thing is you just have to be happy.
Okay, that's it. I should just point out that you did do rather well at the Poly. You were an outstanding student there. You won awards already at that point. So it wasn't that you weren't bad, you weren't good at your studies. So don't...
But I was really bad in the secondary school. How I became a filmmaker was I could only pass 4 subjects. And I needed one more subject to go to polytechnic. So what happened was my school principal offered me this course. They said that, you know, there's this particular course called filmmaking. You have 2 months to learn this. And if you do this well, then you can go to a polytechnic. So this is actually what happened. So with that, it sort of opens up a lot of doors for me. And I fell in love with filmmaking. And that's where I realized that, wow, when I go to Temasek Poly, there are so many other people who also share similar interests as me. And really, in secondary school, I really felt that I was a freak, because like everybody was so busy studying, and then but for me, my heart was never in the textbook, and it was a really difficult journey for me.
Now you say that your upbringing was pretty unorthodox in the sense that you just ran around catching fish in the drains, you know, going a bit wild in the sense that you didn't spend your time being, you know, tuitioned, doing piano lessons or whatever it is. Does this mean, though, that you don't have so much relationship to young Singaporeans now? Will somebody who's 18 now in Singapore be able to relate to your films in the same way?
Thankfully, yes. Because, to be honest, I also direct a lot of TV commercials. So I roughly know the trend where it's going. And also, I've been doing a lot of school tours, average of like 20 school tours a year. So there's a lot of interaction between the youngsters and me during the school talk, and I think right now the biggest problem is because they are so isolated in their own world. They don't have interaction with people. They interact better with computers. So we did the research. Like in the past, back in the 80s, when people had eye contact with one another, without feeling awkward, it was 4.5 seconds. But right now, it was only 2 seconds. Yeah, so, but people are so comfortable with that. So I always try to bring about that this point during my school talk, that we should have more eye contact with people rather than having eye contact with computers.
What do you mean when you say that when we try not to be racist, we become racist? Let's look at one of the issues that has been, coming up now in the Singapore arts scene, and that is whether funding is used as censorship. In other words, when the government or various other bodies that give funding to the arts, do they have a right to say what they think is, so to say, acceptable or unacceptable via the funding? And in other words, to use funding in a way as a tool for censorship, if it can be seen that way. Do you think that that's occurring?
I think to a certain extent, yes. And I feel that art shouldn't be treated this way, using funding as a form of censorship. And I think that ultimately, we should let the audience decide. And stop thinking that audience are children, they can't think, and just a play or two can change their mindset or affect their views on religion and things like that. Yeah, so ultimately, really, it's time for the audience to fight back, because the artists and the group alone, they are, it's not enough. We need to hear a louder voice from the community.
Well, how's that going to be, though? You're presuming, though, that the community will say, hey, we want to support independence amongst the artistic group. What if the What if the community turns around and says, hey, we don't want to give money to Royston Tan? Oh, we don't want to give, you know, to these various projects which we think go against what we believe in or what we think is interesting or valuable in society.
I would like to quote Ivan Heng's Wild Rice. When his funding was cut, what happened was that the public came in to contribute to be the angel for the Wild Rice Company by giving donations so that they can continue their play. So I think there's a big community, and in fact there's a lot of people think that Singaporeans are, I don't know where did this statistic come from, they keep saying that Singaporeans are very conservative and blah 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 blah, blah. But where were all these people? But in fact, if we were to look at our internet culture, I think we were actually really very, very open.
But perhaps taxpayer funding still has to take into account what is in the mainstream of people's beliefs. And, you know, in a way saying that, hey, you should be grateful you're getting any funding at all. It could also go to schools and hospitals.
But I would also want to ask that question, what is mainstream? Yeah, what is this definition of mainstream? Is it guarded by religion or by certain kind of racial thing? You know, sometimes when we try not to be racist, we become racist. That's what I wanted to ask back the same question. Yeah, so... Yeah.
That's an interesting point. What do you mean when you say that when we try not to be racist, we become racist?
Yes, I'll give you one example. There are, sometimes we see certain projects, certain people has been rejected, Indians especially, because they are not dark enough. Yes, so they wanted...
Where did you hear this?
It was a project that I was involved in.
So it was first-hand experience?
First-hand experience, and they were taken out because they are not dark enough. Oh, this Malay kid doesn't look Malay enough because the eyes is too small, look like Chinese.
And they wanted to have, in other words, the stereotyping of the various races.
And all this thing. And they said, oh, okay, how about this? Maybe can we get the Indian girl back and then ask her to put the dot on her forehead so that it's more Indian? But you know, we are overthinking. Personally for me, Singaporeans are Singaporeans. Let's not try to overthink. And in the end, you don't want to be racist, but in the end, you become racist. Mm-hmm. This is what I've been trying to educate the people who I work for. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really, honestly, if I ever can make a wish, it would be that one day censorship will be replaced by discussion. Because only with discussion, then we can all grow together. We can understand each other's differences, and we can reach to a certain agreement to agree to disagree. But right now, this option is not open yet.
Can I play the devil's advocate and say that censorship may always be necessary? Let's say, for example, somebody wants to make a film that shows that paedophilia, sexually abusing children, is acceptable. Or the rather repulsive argument that the child actually enjoys it. What would you say to that then? Would you say that it's okay? Everybody can decide themselves? Or would you accept that there is some baseline that we do not find acceptable within society to show?
If I were to make that choice, I would say show the film. And let the audience watch it and decide for themselves and let them make their decision and to make the call. If the Singapore audience are not given the opportunity to decide for themselves now to be matured, when will the time be? And if they still couldn't decipher what is right and what is wrong in their heart, then there's something could be very, very wrong with our educational system.
But is there a country in the world that has absolutely no censorship?
Even in America, there's also censorship. Yeah. So I think some form of censorship is good. It's good to appease everyone. But again, I would still like to challenge everyone to take that leap of faith to be the judge yourself. Yeah, I think that's more important because we cannot keep living in this protected environment, and one day when something big really just happened, then we all didn't know how to react. We'll all be looking for instruction from the top on how to solve certain issues. And also, I think currently, the audience in Singapore, example, the aunties and uncles, they have all gotten a lot more sophisticated. A lot of people, sometimes when we do shows for television, they say, auntie, uncle, cannot understand this kind of thing, you know. Don't make it a bit lower for them so that they can understand and be more accessible. But no, auntie and uncle have upgraded to, now they have Facebook already.
One of the things that I've noticed about your films, even the more recent ones, you started off pretty hard-hitting, very socially conscious, and your films still are socially conscious, but they've taken on a rather nostalgic hue. Are you going to stay in that genre always? Or do you ever think that one day you might do something that was completely different?
Maybe, I will. I always wanted to do a horror film. Yeah, so that's something on my bucket list that I wanted to do. But for now, because I spent 7 years not making feature film, and I started making documentaries like Old Places, Old Romances and Old Friends, simply because Singapore is changing too quickly already. And if there isn't anyone that's going to document all these places and people, and they're all going to be gone forever. And the magic of film is really immortalize images and stories, sound. And that's what I've been always wanting to do. Because I'm so worried that, you know, I always say this in school talk. Like, one day I'll wake up and then I take my luggage and I go overseas. And then when I come back to my HDB block, right, suddenly my area is gone. It became another shopping center. You know, and there's this fear in me that I'm so worried that I'm not familiar with the environment. So I decided to spend just this 6-7 years to just document as many things as I can. And after that, I think it's enough. I'm going to move on and pass the baton to other filmmakers to continue.
Royce and Tan, thank you very much for talking to us on Conversation With. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.